to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, March the 8th. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. First, let's take a look at the weather for eastern Iowa. Today, we're expecting a very nice day again, a partly cloudy day with winds from the southwest at 10 to 20 miles per hour, and Cedar Rapids will climb to a high of 62 and 63 in Iowa City, and then falling to a low above freezing tonight of 43 in Cedar Rapids and 44 in Iowa City. Sunset tonight is at 6:06 p.m. and sunrise tomorrow morning at 7:28 a.m. for a total daylight period of 11 hours and 36 minutes. And now from the front page of today's Gazette, Managing a Year of Pandemic, Herculean versus Inept. This is a story by Aaron Murphy of the Gazette staff from the Des Moines Bureau. When the COVID-19 pandemic first reached the state 1 year ago today, Governor Kim Reynolds, assured Iowans her administration was ready. "I want Iowans to know that I am confident that we are prepared, that we take this situation seriously, and we will manage it responsibly," Reynolds said during a news conference after Iowa's first three cases were confirmed in Johnson County. A year later, Iowa ranks in the bottom third of states for the most critical public health comparisons, but the state's economy and state finances appear to be strong. And partly as a result, opinions on the state's pandemic response are mixed. Over the course of the pandemic, over 5,500 Iowans have died of COVID-19 related causes. As of Friday, Iowa's rate of COVID-19 deaths per capita was the 15th highest in the country, federal statistics show. Iowa's rate of COVID-19 cases per capita fares worse, 9th highest in the country over the course of the pandemic, according to the federal data. Early in the pandemic, Reynolds ordered schools and many non-essential businesses closed. Schools never came back in person to finish the 2019-2020 academic year. But by late spring and early summer, Reynolds began allowing businesses to reopen with restrictions. Reynolds resisted issuing a shelter-at-home order, and for the first 8 months of the pandemic, resisted a public face mask requirement. But by November, when COVID-19 cases, hospitalizations, and deaths in Iowa began to surge to unprecedented levels, Reynolds issued a limited mask requirement and reenacted some mitigation steps for businesses. Throughout the pandemic, Reynolds declined to heed the advice of public health and infectious disease experts in Iowa and the federal government, who called for stronger mitigation strategies. Reynolds regularly expressed her confidence in Iowa's to, quote, do the right thing, end quote, without a government mandate. Throughout the pandemic, Reynolds also regularly said her duty as governor is to balance the need to protect both Iowans' lives and their livelihoods, meaning she feels compelled to institute public health measures, but not go so far as to disrupt the economy. Now, with cases, hospitalizations, and deaths all in steady decline since that tragic winter surge, Reynolds has lifted the public face mask requirement and nearly all restrictions on businesses and public gatherings. When asked recently to assess her administration's handling of the state's pandemic response over the past year, Reynolds praised her staff, all state agencies and employees, public partners, and nonprofits that have worked on state response efforts. "Every day we learned something new about COVID-19, she said. "I'm really proud of the Herculean team effort that I think we've put in place to help serve Iowans through this really difficult time." When it comes to independent assessments of the state's pandemic response, public health and medical experts were critical, while business leaders were far more approving. Dr. Austin Baith, an internal medicine physician in Des Moines, provided a harsh assessment of the state's response. Quote, "generally inadequate and inept and ignorant of science," end quote, Baith said. It was clear that the state's public health policy was actually prioritizing business over public health. Baith was one of the organizers of a statewide group of physicians who in early August held a news conference at the Iowa Capitol to implore Reynolds to institute a public face mask requirement. In assessing the state's pandemic response, Baith referred to the national health data that show Iowa performing poorly compared with other states. The numbers don't lie. We could have done much better, and the majority of states in America did much better than we did in saving lives. And the pandemic isn't over, Baith said. I understand the need to balance people's lives with public health, but I think it's important to remember there is no livelihood without life. And I don't know about you, but I would rather be out of work than be dead. Besides being a physician, Baith is a restaurant owner. He has a pizza place near Drake University. We also suffer financially from business restrictions, Baith said. But we understand it, and we would rather take a hit financially than be party to infecting and killing people. Dan Gervich, who is retired after working for nearly 40 years as an epidemiologist and infectious disease physician in Des Moines, also offered a harsh criticism. He, too, pointed to the data in which Iowa compares unfavorably with other states and in which the United States compared unfavorably with many other nations. I think when we look back on this, you would have to say that Team USA and Team Iowa are losers, Gervich said. If the governor was a coach of a major sports team, a major Hawkeye, or major Cyclone sports team, she'd be gone. Like Baith, Gervich said he understands the need for government leaders to thread the needle between protecting the public health and the economy. What leaders, governors, presidents, should be trying to do is to try to find a theoretic sweet spot, minimizing mortality and economic impact. Try to find a sweet spot in there, Gervich said. Many Iowa business leaders feel Reynolds did find that sweet spot. Few industries have suffered more economic damage and faced more state restrictions during the pandemic than restaurants and bars. Yet, Jessica Dunker, president and chief executive officer of the Iowa Restaurant Association, praised Reynolds' administration and myriad state agencies for how they've worked to help businesses attempt to stay afloat. From the very beginning, we felt the governor's office was trying to weigh the business interests with public health, Dunker said. We were asking for financial assistance on March 18, the day after Reynolds ordered many businesses closed, and the Iowa Economic Development Authority had a grant program out in 10 days. That's unbelievable when you stop and think about it. You look at that level of state cooperation, and they were really committed to try to keep businesses surviving. They went to the absolute brink of what was their legislative limit. Mike Ralston, president of the Iowa Association of Business and Industry, said businesses across Iowa were comfortable adhering to Reynolds' public health orders. Ralston said many took matters into their own hands once the pandemic hit Iowa by seeking out personal protective equipment and instituting safe public health practices. All the mitigation strategies that the state and county health departments talk about, folks put those in place, and most of them still have them in place, Ralston said. The state public health department has had its ups and downs over the course of the pandemic. While the state's website that publishes the latest state pandemic data has been rated highly and compared favorably with other states, the department has changed its data reporting methods on multiple occasions, making it harder for Iowans to keep track. A former department spokeswoman also has sued the governor's staff, alleging she was pushed out after fulfilling media requests for pandemic information. The governor has denied the allegations, and the lawsuit has not gone to trial. Department Deputy Director Sarah Reisetter and State Epidemiologist Dr. Caitlin Padati were prominent figures in the early public presentations on the state's pandemic response. They since have been largely replaced in that public role by Kelly Garcia, who in June was named the department's interim director. Also from today's front page, high school sports continue in the pandemic. School districts vary on masks, fans, and cancellations. This is a story by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette staff. A year ago this week, Iowa High School Athletic Association leaders were sitting in a room in the Wells Fargo Arena in Des Moines trying to decide what to do about the state basketball finals. The NCAA had just canceled all winter and spring championships, including the men's and women's basketball tournaments, and K-12 school districts were postponing events and calling off practices after it became clear that COVID-19 was spreading in Iowa. From that point to where we are now, we were making decisions and recommendations based on limited information, said Tom Keating, executive director of the association that governs all boys high school sports in the state. The association decided to let the championship games continue March 14, 2020, but limited fans to 100 per school. Sports have escaped some of Iowa's most severe restrictions of the COVID-19 pandemic. Iowa was the only state in the country to allow high school baseball and softball last summer. When COVID-19 cases were surging again in November, Governor Kim Reynolds prohibited indoor gatherings of more than 15 people, but exempted high school and college sports as long as organizers required fans to wear masks and maintain social distancing. Although some school districts, including Iowa City and Des Moines, just started 100% in-person schooling February 15 in response to a state law, high school sports have maintained practices, games, and in many cases, tournaments. We weren't held necessarily to the same stringent standards, Keating said of high school sports. Part of it was the protocols we were able to put in place. We had more direct supervision on the people involved in the activities. We may have 2, 3, or 4 coaches directing 18 or 19 kids. There was somebody supervising these protocols. We felt good that the kids were doing what we needed them to do. Not everyone agrees with state decisions allowing sports to proceed. I had a hard time with this when it started up, said Colleen Elliott, supervisor of health services for the College Community School District, which serves about 5,800 students from Lynn, Benton, and Johnson counties. If we're still in learning cohorts, why are we back to playing sports full-time? Where is our priority here? Elliott said she sees particular risks for youth club sports, where teams from multiple states are gathering for tournaments every weekend. While the State Athletic Association and the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Association Union have told school districts to comply with state COVID-19 restrictions, they have left many other decisions to the school districts. Iowa City West has required all athletes, coaches, and fans to wear masks, a stricter policy than many of the schools they play. At a regional final February 23 in Iowa City, the West girls basketball team was masked on and off the court, while Davenport North players did not wear masks while playing. I have to give a lot of credit to our coaching staff in our girls basketball program, said Craig Hugel, Iowa City West athletic director. Since the beginning of the winter season, they have adopted the mantra of whatever it takes for us to play. They are very good about wearing their masks. They schedule hand sanitizing breaks into the middle of practice. We try to do everything we can to reduce risk. Shannon and Isaac Wilmington drove from Davenport to Iowa City to watch their daughter, Ivy, play in what would be the last basketball game of her senior season. Shannon said it's hard for anyone to know if COVID-19 precautions will keep kids safe. They are doing the best they can with the situation, she said. We're just happy to get a season. Lots of Iowa high school teams canceled competitions over the year because of COVID-19. It's usually not clear when a school cancels whether a student on the team tested positive or if members were quarantining because of exposure elsewhere. Keating said the number of COVID-19 cases he's aware of that were spread among teams in Iowa are limited. What we're hearing from schools was if they had to shut down, quarantine for 14 days, It was contracted outside the team, and so they didn't spread it to other groups. They shut it down, he said. Cedar Rapids Washington High School canceled its junior varsity men's swimming invitational in January because with athletes and coaches for 12 teams, there were too many people to maintain social distancing, said Grant Schultz, associate principal and activities director. Having to make a decision far enough out, but still not knowing what things will be like when it would have happened, Schultz said, you tend to be on a more conservative side. Washington started off the basketball season, allowing each player to invite two family members to watch. That expanded to all family members within the household. The last week of the season, Washington allowed immediate family plus two others, so grandparents or neighbors could come, Schultz said. West Delaware High hosted the WAMAC Wrestling Tournament February 1 with no fans, assistant principal and activities director Matt Weiss said. With 14 schools in the Eastern Iowa Conference, allowing fans to would have meant unsafe crowding. There was a time in the winter season when the numbers were starting to rise and people were really concerned we couldn't make it through, Weiss said. Our fans were very grateful our kids were able to compete and keep going. Mask use has been contentious in Iowa, and the degree to which a school district enforces mask wearing reflects the community's view on the subject. Photos from the state wrestling tournament, February 17 through 20 in Des Moines, show inconsistent mask use, despite the Athletic Association and Wells Fargo Arena requiring masks for fans. It was probably 50-50 on wearing masks, especially on wearing masks properly, said Hugel, who attended the tournament February 18. Keating said the association hoped fans would follow signs and materials sent to the teams. We did see some people who didn't have masks on, he said. They were directed by security to resolve that. Some were eating, and that's a hard one to say. Were they eating or not eating? But as the week went on, security ramped up, and there was better mask use, Keating said. In sports where athletes want to give 110%, and fans believe their cheers can help the team win, sometimes passion overwhelms common sense, like when a coach pulls down his face mask to talk with his closely huddled team during a timeout, even though health experts say COVID-19 is spread through droplets from a person's mouth or nose. At the collegiate level, you see it at the pro level, Keating said. It's kind of like it won't matter if I do this for 15 seconds, when we know it is a big deal. We will continue to remind our folks about that. The safety has to be first. Keating said he's talked with other state sports leaders about how to stay vigilant about COVID-19, which likely will be around for some time, even with increasing vaccinations. Once we were allowed to play, and people have gotten used to the games going on, it's easy to take that for granted and start to slip those things that have allowed us to do this, he said. That's the one danger of getting back to what we call normal. Turning to today's opinion page, we have a guest column by David V. Wendell entitled A Shot Felt Around the World. March 24 is International Tuberculosis Day. In the midst of a global virus pandemic, why is this significant? Because it was 100 years ago that Albert Calmette and Camille Guérin of France announced the success of the BCG vaccine in preventing the tuberculosis disease. At the time, its symptoms of chronic cough, fever, and shortness of breath afflicted 150 of every 100,000 people in the United States. At its height, the case rate was 53% per 100,000. However, with the development and distribution of the vaccine in 2020, there were only 540 reported tuberculosis-related deaths in America worldwide, thanks in part to vaccination and education efforts around the globe. In the last 20 years, the mortality rate of TB around the planet has plummeted by nearly 50%. 120 years ago, smallpox also was a plague upon our country and our world. Cleveland, for example, in 1901, with a population about the same as today's, in metropolitan Lynn and Johnson counties, saw 1,300 victims of the disease, which causes rash, blistering, fever, and often death. The following year, vaccinations against it were required in order to enroll in public school, and with more than 100,000 inoculations administered, by 1903, there were only 22 deaths caused by the illness in the city. From a malady that killed an estimated 300 million people worldwide in the 20th century, smallpox, through vaccination programs, was medically classified as eradicated in 1977. Rubella, known more commonly as the German measles, as recently as the mid-1960s, afflicted 12.5 million Americans with its fever, rash, and diarrhea, more tragically, by being passed to the fetus in the womb, it led to learning disabilities, vision impairment, and low birth weight in 20,000 infants that year. In the 1970s, Paul Parkman and Harry Meyer, the latter holding the equivalent position within the National Institutes of Health at the time, as is now held by Anthony Fauci, announced the release of a vaccine against rubella, and by 1990, there were fewer than 2,000 cases of German measles in the United States. Another persistent pestilence in the country and around the world was pertussis, an illness spawned by bacteria resulting in a buildup of fluids in the lungs, causing chronic coughing, known as whooping cough. In 1934, Pearl Kendrick and Grace Elderling, teachers from Michigan, along with renowned African-American chemist Loney Gordon, launched a study of 5,815 school students, giving them shots of a vaccine they had produced against the disease. The study proved the inoculations to be 90% effective. From a staggering 270,000 cases of pertussis nationwide in 1935, after World War II, through a cross-country immunization effort, by the 1990s, there were fewer than 3,000 cases of whooping cough reported in the United States. To battle these illnesses and assure that vaccines to prevent them were safe, 99 years ago, in 1902, Congress passed the Biologics Control Act, also known as the Virus Toxin Law. With it, the Hygienic Laboratory of Public Health was established as a government-run facility to test and regulate biologics, medical products made from living sources such as people, plants, animals, and microorganisms. It coordinated the verification of immunizations and serums as safe for human use. The HLPH was renamed the National Institutes of Health in 1930, with its research center and headquarters in Bethesda, Maryland. Today, the compound sits on a high hill of several hundred acres and is crowned by more than 50 buildings, including the National Library of Medicine, the largest biomedical research library in the world, having moved there from its origins in Ford's Theater after plays ceased following the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. While information on the studies of immunology are housed within its 50 miles of largely underground bookshelves, the actual process of verifying the validity of all biologics was transferred to the Food and Drug Administration, operated by the Department of Health and Human Services, in 1972. One of the vaccines against the COVID-9 virus they will be reviewing is a recent one by Novavax, a pharmaceuticals company also located in Maryland. The Novavax vaccine is different from others by Pfizer and Moderna, in that rather than injecting a strain of the virus into the body, it inserts only a small portion of it, known as the spike protein, which triggers the immune system, but because only part of the virus is introduced, cannot result in clinical COVID-19. The University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics is one of the medical facilities nationwide that is participating in the trial study of the new vaccine that hopes to test 30,000 volunteers in the protocol by spring. The project in Iowa is headed by Dr. Patricia Winokur, Dean of Carver College of Medicine and an infectious disease specialist. She also spearheaded the university's clinical trial of the Pfizer vaccine late last year. So as we observe International Tuberculosis Day in March, think of the vaccines that have virtually eradicated illnesses that would have otherwise taken the lives of grandmothers, grandfathers, moms and dads, and their children. And remember the virologists, including those at the University of Iowa, who have helped to make certain that these diseases will not afflict your grandchildren, great-grandchildren, or any other generation to come. That piece by David V. Wendell, a Marion historian, author, and special events coordinator specializing in American history. And then turning to today's community letters, the first one is entitled Bill to Ban Most Traffic Cams Makes Roads Less Safe. This is an article by John Carver from Decorah. The legislature's best bet would be to set the budget and go home. Come back next year refreshed and make discernible legislation. Working this traffic camera concern is off the rails. No safety there. They have highlighted the S-curve in Cedar Rapids as the only remnant of use. You would think this was the juggled bottle bill. Road safety includes all of the roads and the S-curve. Unhinged car drivers reaching speeds of up to 100 miles an hour are as much of a threat as an S-curve. Why is that so difficult to understand? People don't want to be caught, let alone have to pay a fine. Maybe the IRS has more impact when not paying taxes. Jail time? As long as the law makes its statement, then deal with it. The argument of cities making money probably helps reduce property taxes. Okay, the supplier is also making money. So what's new about that? That's how systems work. The other side of the coin is enforcement agents are free to get other bad guys and gals. A camera has taken their place without a whimper. How lucky can you get? And that article by John Carver of Decorah. The next letter comes from Steve Springer of Cedar Rapids, and his piece is entitled Federal Relief Bill is Full of Unneeded Political Pork. Please understand, I am all in favor of helping those that are really in need, of spending money to retrain people whose jobs may not come back, and so on. However, I have personally gone through some of the proposed stimulus bill, and it is full of spending that has nothing to do with helping those in need. And the fact that these expenditures are consciously added to the bill by our elected officials does nothing but reinforce the opinion that our government is broken. Also, on top of the non-pandemic-related spending are billions of dollars that are allocated now, but available through 2023. The fact that this bill is being touted as immediate support for immediate needs and still contain allocations that can lay dormant to 2023 is offensive, and I can't believe any individual or group can claim they're acting in the best interest of those suffering from the results of the pandemic. Why hasn't the public been told about these items in the bill? My only conclusion is that everyone in the government has a little pork in the stew, and thus everyone is afraid to stir the pot. Think about this. If you live to be 80 years old, to accumulate $1 trillion, you would have to earn $34 million each day of your life, and our government loads this bill with non-related junk that helps bring the total to $1.9 trillion, and they want us to cheer. And that piece by Steve Springer of Cedar Rapids. And you're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, March the 8th, on Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. First from Garnavillo, Eldoris Marie Borcherding, age 80, went home to be with her Lord and Savior on Thursday, March the 4th. Arrangements are being handled by the Twig Allen Funeral Home at 1 South Industrial Park Road in Garnavillo, where the family will greet friends from 1 to 4 p.m. Sunday, March the 7th. Funeral service will be at St. Paul's Lutheran Church at 10:30 a.m. Monday, March 8th. Interment will be at the Garnavillo Community Cemetery in Garnavillo. From Keystone, Marty Lorenz Andreessen, age 65, passed away peacefully on Saturday, March the 6th, at Sunny Crest in Dysart, surrounded by his family. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, March the 10th, at the Phillips Funeral Home in Keystone. Interment will be held at the Keystone Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday at the funeral home. And from Marion, Teresa Lorraine Jepson, age 95, died February 27 at the Anamosa Care Center. Visitation is at the Schultz Funeral Home in DeWitt from 10 a.m. Friday until service time at noon Friday at St. Joseph Catholic Cemetery in until a service at noon Friday at St. Joseph Catholic Cemetery in DeWitt. And in other death notices today from Garnavillo, Bertha Claire Barrand, age 54, died Thursday, March the 4th. The Toik Allen Funeral Home in Garnavillo is assisting the family. And from Naples, Florida, Penelope Bjornson, age 85, died Friday, March the 5th. The Cedar Park Memorial Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. From Toddville, Harold L. Lanning, age 94, died Saturday, March the 6th. The Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion is assisting the family. And from Decorah, Virginia M. Sequintney, age 91, died Thursday, March the 4th. The Joystall Funeral Home in Decorah is assisting the family. And from Brandon, Helen G. Welch, age 93, died Thursday, March the 4th. The White Funeral Home in Independence is assisting the family. And from Grinnell, Michael J., also known as Mike Doyle, age 77, of rural Gilman and Grinnell, died Saturday, March the 6th. The Cruz Phillips Funeral Home in Grinnell is assisting the family. From Cedar Rapids, Harvey Lant, age 84, died Sunday, March the 7th. The Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. And from Olin, LaVon Catherine Marling passed away on March the 5th at her home in Olin. A private family burial will be held at Mount Hope in Independence, Iowa. The Dawson Funeral Home in Olin is assisting the family. Turning to today's sports page, we have an article about boys' state basketball entitled Lynx Have a State Tourney Assembly Line. This is a story by Jeff Johnson of the Gazette staff. And from Troy Mills, there was a season within the last decade when North Lynn's boys basketball team wasn't too good. Just one. The 2013-14 Lynx went 8-15 and averaged under 40 points per game. Their leading scorer averaged only 7.9 points. This was an anomaly, as North Lynn won a combined 80 games the 4 years before that offseason. Then there is what has come after it. The Lynx have qualified for 5 consecutive state tournaments. They are 25-0, top-ranked and top-seeded, going into their Class 1A quarterfinal today at Wells Fargo Arena against South Winneshe. That only scratches the surface, though. We've gotten to talking about how have we been so lucky, Coach Mike Hilmer said. I was talking to girls coach Brian Wheatley about it, because it's not only our boys, but our girls have done the same thing, been so good for several years. We were trying to figure it out, how fortunate we are as coaches to have such great athletes. We've just happened to have all the pieces. We always seem to have just enough kids who have a passion for the game, that learn the game at a young age and play on AAU teams. We've had the luck of nobody getting hurt, and we've been able to overcome them when we have had injuries. Hilmer is in his 22nd season at North Lynn, and these are the proverbial salad days of his coaching career. There are the 5 straight trips to state, the 153-5 overall record since 2015 and 2016, the 99 consecutive non-state tournament wins, the fact that the Lynx haven't lost to a fellow Tri-Rivers Conference foe in the regular season or postseason since a district lost to Alburnett in 2016. Incredible stuff, especially from a small public school. We've had coaches and parents with great athletic backgrounds running our youth programs for several years, Homer said. So it's just parents that buy in. We've had zero, and when I say that, I mean 100% zero, issues with parents or kids about who plays and who doesn't play. Not any of that stuff. Nothing. I think that's pretty rare. This run all kind of began with the 2014-15 team, one that went 18-6, its leading scorer being a freshman named Ryan Miller, who would go on to become the Gazette's Male Athlete of the Year as a senior and who now plays at Grandview University. The next season, Hilmer's son Jake joined the varsity and made it a 1-2 punch of excellent young players. North Lynn went 21-2 with that district loss to Alburnett. It made it to the state the following season, going unbeaten until losing to Gladbrook Rhinebeck in the semifinals, beating Remsen St. Mary's for third place. The only loss in 2017 and 18 came in the 1A championship game by 3 to Granville Christian. North Lynn moved up to 2A in 2018 and 19, led by co-Mr. Basketball Jake Hilmer, and won it all, finishing 26-0. Last season, despite graduating Hilmer and three other important seniors, the Lynx were 26-1, losing in the 2A title tilt to Boyden Hull. Now there's this year's group. When it first started, I was obviously in middle school, but it was pretty incredible to watch them those first couple of years, said junior guard Austin Hilmer, Jake's brother, and the leading scorer on this team. Then I think it's what motivated the groups behind them. Once we watched them be successful, we just wanted to emulate what they were doing. I think that's how it all started. You get one group winning, and everyone else wants to follow them and continue to do what they've been doing. It's something that is great to be a part of, and I'm proud to be a part of, senior forward Caleb Kurt said. We get out there and we work our butts off all season and all off season to do what we want to do and get down to the well like we have the last 5 seasons. Kurt's record in his 4 years on varsity is an absurd 105-2. He's the only senior on the roster and doesn't start, which means you can't expect North Lynn to keep winning and winning. They all expressed surprise, by the way, about going unbeaten this season because the Tri-Rivers was as good and deep as it has ever been. We're like brothers out there, Kurt said. We work together. We're always working together in the off-season and stuff. So it really just comes together then during the season. We spend all weekend together. I mean, there's not a time during the season when we're not hanging out and stuff. I think the team aspect of it really helps us be successful. That's how it's been since I was a freshman for sure. The culture of success has been built in this program, has been built around togetherness. It's a unique and special thing when freshmen and sophomores are accepted by their older peers. It's a sign of the quality of the kids, Coach Hilmer said. For the last 5 years, he's asked every member of his team to sign a pledge that they will be alcohol and drug free during the season. That might sound like a small thing, but it's really not in today's culture. I sent out a tweet, I think it was 2 years ago, on New Year's Eve night, saying how nice it was as a coach to know that we don't have to practice at 5 in the morning just to make sure our kids aren't doing something that they're not supposed to do, Hilmer said. Austin got a text literally within a half hour from a kid from another school with the kid saying, "You have some kids that drink, right?" Austin was like, "No, we have 21 kids on the team and nobody drinks." The kid was flabbergasted. Obviously, that doesn't mean we've never had a kid in our program drink, but over the last 5 years in particular, it's been kids with high character, kids with parents of high character, kids that get along and include everybody in what they're doing. The manager, the freshman, it doesn't matter who you are, you are included when they get together after games and whatnot, which is pretty neat. They insist there's no pressure that goes with all of this success. They're confident they will be a loose group in Des Moines. We just feel fortunate to play for the community that we do, play for the coaches we do, and have the teammates we do, Austin Hilmer said. Just play it one game at a time, and hopefully you continue to do what we've been doing over the last 6 years. Turning to today's Dear Abby, her column today is entitled, Playful Name Calling Isn't Fun Anymore. Dear Abby, my girlfriend and I call each other horrible names as a form of, quote, love, end quote. Recently, I asked her to stop calling me names like that because it was fun at first, but now not so much. I love her, and I want to show it by my actions. I now call her BB, or Beeb. She got mad and accused me of not letting her be herself. Am I wrong for asking her not to call me ugly gender-based names? I know she loves me. I just want her to tone down the name-calling. Is that too much to ask? And that's signed No Dumb A... in California. And Abby responds, people who love each other are sensitive to the other person's feelings, and don't do what your girlfriend is doing. If she persists, it may be time to reevaluate the relationship, because her just being herself will become a turnoff. Dear Abby, my husband has bad table manners. He smacks when he chews, makes gulping noises, and stuffs food in his mouth. He once swallowed a whole hard-boiled egg and almost choked. I love him, but his lack of manners is embarrassing. What can I do? That's signed Rolling My Eyes in Tennessee. Abby responds, have you talked to him about this? If you have, sometimes a picture is worth a thousand words. Hand him a mirror or record a video of him eating so he can see how unappealing he looks when he does this. If that doesn't persuade him, consider putting less food on his plate. I can't guarantee this will work, but it's worth a try. Turning to today's community page, we have an article called Staging a New Season. The area arts venues begin ramping up spring events. And this is a story by Ty Smead of the Gazette staff. Just as spring brings a mix of sunshine and showers, area arts presenters are bringing a mix of in-person and online events to usher in the season. Here are a few of the upcoming ways they're continuing to connect with viewers at home and afar. From the Alliant Energy Powerhouse, the address is in-person shows at 370 First Avenue Northeast in Cedar Rapids. The Eli Young Band is at 8 p.m., March 24. Tickets are $28 to $68. It's a modern country band with Texas roots, multiple award nominations, and Billboard's 2011 number one country song of the year and 2012 ACM Awards song of the year, both for Crazy Girl. Then there's Cavalcade of Cars from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. April the 3rd. Cost is $10 and free to ages 10 and under and active military. It's a classic car show with restored muscle cars, customs, low riders, exotics, rat rods, and movie cars. And the Cinch World's Toughest Rodeo. It's from 1 to 8 p.m. May 8. Cost is $20 to $65. And clear purses and bags will be allowed. Face coverings are required unless eating or drinking. Details at creventslive.com/return-to-live. Then there's the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater. Viewing online, The Enchanted Forest. It's the second Thursday series, digital production, 7 p.m. March 11 on youtube.com/Cedar Rapids Opera. And after that, at cropera.org, free, A Tale of Friendship, Peril, and Finding Your Innate Capabilities. It's voiced by CR Opera Young Artists with a visual component by Eulenspiegel Puppet Theater. The details are at cropera.org/TheEnchantedForest2021. And then there's City Circle, viewing online, acting out while staying in. It's from April 9 to 11. Tickets are $12 to $17. Local artists Christopher Okaishi, Brian Tanner, and co-writers Janet Schlapkuhl and Paul David Story present three 30-minute plays with one unifying theme, the living room. Tickets details are at coralvillearts.org. And at the Coralville Center for the Performing Arts at 1301 Fifth Avenue in Coralville, Storytelling, a Pandemic Play. Young Footlighters are live online at 7 p.m. March 12 and 13 and at 2 p.m. March 14. Tickets are $10 per person or $50 per household. Chloe, age 12, hasn't seen her grandfather in person for months. To stay connected, he tells her stories over Zoom. But Chloe is a storyteller herself, and as the stories twist and turn, both Grandpa and Chloe learn a little bit more about each other and the value of stories when we're living in separate worlds. This is written by Matt Falduto. And Elvis Rock and Remember, an in-person concert with Joseph Hall at 7 p.m., April 23. Tickets are $17 to $32. Tickets can be purchased for earlier postponed date. That have been purchased for an earlier postponed date will be honored. And Beatles vs. the Stones, in-person musical showdown by tribute bands Abbey Road and Satisfaction. It's at 7:30 p.m. April 28. Tickets are $37 to $57, and tickets purchased for earlier postponed date will be honored. And at the Englert Theater, viewing online, Stages Season, more than 30 streaming performances, including music and storytelling, $250 season pass or individual show prices from $5 to $25. And Partner Live Stream, Taj Mahal and Phantom Blues Band at 8 p.m. March 13. $18 to $80 is the fee. Roots Rising Showcased at 8 p.m. March 20. $18 to $80. And Taj Mahal and Fantastic Negrito at 8 p.m. March 27. $18 to $80. This is the englert.org/events. And there's Giving Tree Theater, in-person productions at 752 10th Street in Marion. The first is Yearbook, a youth production, at 7:30 p.m. March the 12th and 13th, 2 p.m. March 14. Tickets are $18. Susan and Beth enlist other students to help move the boxes of yearbooks that just arrived. Between loads, they flip through the pages, reminiscing about the year's highlights. And Irish Jam, at 8 p.m. March 19 and 20, tickets are $22. Local artists, music by Irish Jam, Irish Storytelling by Darren Crow. And the Brothers Grimm Speculatathon, from April 9 to 19 at 8 p.m. Friday, Saturday, and 2 p.m. Sunday. Tickets are $23. Grimm fairy tales are turned on their heads as two narrators and several actors attempt to combine all 209 stories into one show. COVID-19 precautions, masks are required when not in your seat, and see more at givingtreetheater.com/pages/COVID-19 precautions. And from Hancher Auditorium, viewing online conversations with Mark Morris, moderated by journalist Paula Zahn. Choreographer Mark Morris speaks with composer Nico Muley at 7:30 p.m. March 11, with Chef Alice Waters at 7:30 p.m. March 11. It's free, but registration is required. And at the at Hancher, United We Swing, Jazz and American History, Jazz at Lincoln Center Lecture Series Topics, Louis Armstrong at 7 p.m. March 24, Billie Holiday at 7 p.m. March 31, Duke Ellington at 7 p.m. April 7, Charlie Parker at 7 p.m. April 14, John Coltrane at 7 p.m. April 21, and Wynton Marsalis at 7 p.m. April 28. It's free, but registration is required. The Pacifica Quartet and Anthony McGill is principal clarinetist for the New York Philharmonic. That's at 7:30 p.m. March the 30th. It's $5. Concert created for Hancher audiences and music by Johann Brahms and Joaquin Turina, as well as Shulamit Ron's Glitter, Doom, and Shards Memory, co-commissioned by Hancher via the Music Accord Consortium. And we do have a couple of, actually three, Eastern Iowa briefs today. The first is entitled COVID-Related Counseling. Funding for free mental wellness visits now is available to anyone experiencing anxiety, insomnia, stress, or relationship problems, or who are simply not feeling themselves because of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's at Unity Point Health, Abbey Health Services, and is partnering with Hillcrest Family Services in Dubuque to offer the free sessions previously reserved for teachers and school employees. The grant now is open to all residents of Benton, Buchanan, Bremer, Delaware, Dubuque, Iowa, Jones, Johnson, and Linn counties, regardless of income level. The grant covers up to 5 individual sessions, which can be held in person or via telehealth. Individuals also may choose to join virtual support groups to talk with peers and provide mutual support. Grant funds are available through June. For more information, contact Abbey Center for Community Mental Health at 319-398-3562 or Hillcrest Family Services at 563-207-5494. And from Johnson County, celebrate Women's Day with an online dinner event. The Night of 1,000 Dinners, a virtual community celebration of International Women's Day, will be held Wednesday from 6 to 7 p.m. via Zoom. The event is hosted by the Johnson County Chapter of the United Nations Association and 21 co-sponsoring organizations. International Women's Day honors the achievements and contributions of women worldwide. The Johnson County celebration will recognize 3 local organizations. Proceeds from the event will be donated to the United Nations World Food Program, Community Crisis Services and the Food Bank, the Coralville Community Food Pantry, and the North Liberty Community Pantry. Tickets are $25 per household or $10 for students and those impacted by the pandemic. Tickets may be purchased online at eventbrite.com. Donations also are accepted. Ticket purchasers and donors will receive a Zoom link for the event. And from Cedar Rapids, African American Banner Project seeks submissions. The African American Museum of Iowa is accepting submissions for a banner project that recognizes and honors African American Iowans who are current or former members of the U.S. Armed Services. The project is intended to recognize and show appreciation for African American veterans and military personnel and their families who have ties to Iowa. Banners will display a photo of the service person, as well as their name, branch, and dates of service. They will be displayed on the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Bridge. Banners will be unveiled leading up to Memorial Day. Submissions are limited to the first 32 completed forms on a first-come, first-served basis and are due by March 15 or when the banner spots have been filled. For more information, contact Community Communications Coordinator William Whitten at 319-862-2101, extension 214, or W. Whitten, that's W-W-H-I-T-T-E-N, at blackiowa.org. And our pet of the week is Tank. Tank is a 2-year-old pit bull terrier mix, available for adoption at the Cedar Valley Humane Society at 7411 Mount Vernon Road Southeast. Tank is big and sweet, but needs work on his leash manners. He also appears to think he's a human, as he likes to sit in one sit one in a chair or bed. The shelter is open by appointment only. Call 319-362-6288 for more information. And that does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, March the 8th. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website at iowaradioreading.org at any time. And thank you for listening.